Hello, this is John Galloway.
And this is Jesse Liberty.
And this is the Full Stack Videocast, a pair programming experiment where we build out a full working application spanning from server to web and phone and everything else in between while you watch.
Hi, Jesse.
John.
Yes.
How are you?
So I'm good. So let me see. Last we were looking on, we've been kind of bouncing between client and server. We were last looking at the, we started on the server. We built out some things on the client. We hopped back over to the server, set up unit testing, and began building out a repository. Now we're back on the client. You were going to show off what you've been working on. And then also, talking about this earlier, that we're kind of using the clients to drive what we need the server pieces to do. So I thought you had a good analogy for this earlier.
Oh, yes. We were talking about moving back and forth between client and server, and I said that for me it's in many ways like doing a crossword puzzle or even a jigsaw puzzle where you go to the parts that are obvious and easy and you fill those in, and then once those are in, they make other parts become easier to do, and then you progressively work your way towards the solution. But you don't, in my mind, you don't start in one corner and work your way all the way through linearly to the end. You need to move back and forth and have each piece fill in and influence the other pieces.
Right.
A bit of a labored analogy, but perhaps.
No, I think it makes sense.
So, yes, I think you're right. We are, and I think it's a good thing, moving back and forth between server and client and server, and filling in pieces as we go, and also tolerating that much of what we're doing is exploration and not necessarily final and certainly isn't the final look and feel. And so I've made a little bit more progress, for example, on this page on the phone for gathering information. But on the one hand, I might argue that it's finished in the sense that it gathers all the information and it does work. On the other hand, it's far from finished because it certainly needs a UI designer to come in and make some suggestions. Although I have to say we've been very lucky. Corey Schumann has taken a look a couple times and just made a couple key suggestions, and I can show those to you as we look at this today. So why don't we jump into this and take a quick review of this?
Sure.
This has progressed a little bit since you last saw it. Let me run it. It's the easiest way to show you what progress has been made, and then we can discuss how some of that was done and move on to the next thing. So, again, you'll remember this page was for gathering a description of the individual. So when I click into the text box, I can put in the person's name. Now, this is the SIP, the soft interface panel, the onboard keyboard. There is a way, in fact, to use an external keyboard. Some of the phones have external keyboards, and if you're in the simulator, as I am, then what you can do is hit the pause key, and that says, pretend that I'm using an external keyboard, and that actually lets me use my computer's keyboard, which is very convenient. Okay, so now the checkboxes work, of course, and I'm sorry, the radio buttons work, and the checkboxes work, and you can scroll down and decide what kind of facial hair the person has. The other thing that I did was I put a target for the SIP on the phone number, saying that it's explaining that it is a phone number, and therefore I get, you notice, a different keyboard, a much easier to deal with phone keyboard rather than the keyboard that I get up here with the name, where I get a full alphabetic keyboard.
Okay.
The key thing that I was working on, let me move out of that. The key thing that I was working on were these. You'll remember that you had made the suggestion of making these buttons. And I first used toggle buttons. I ended up actually using buttons just as you suggested. What I wanted, one problem that I had was, I know that the panel is going to open up, for example, for eye color. If I open the panel, it'll be hidden because it'll be too low. So I decided that what I wanted to do when I click on eye color is to scroll eye color up to the top and open the panel. So that now is working. It scrolls to the top. Change the coloring on the panel a little bit. And the second thing was what I had originally was you click on the color that you want, and then it would change here, and then you'd have to click here to shut the panel. And that seemed really silly. So now when you make a choice, it puts it in place and closes the panel, because typically that you're done at that point. One of Corey's suggestions that I thought was very good was to change the background like this on the button so that it invites you that this is different from this. hair color here is just a prompt. There's nothing to click on. This sort of indicates that this is a fill-in or something to click on. And when you do, it opens up the choice for you, and you can pick one and then just drop it in. So that
great.
I think works out, you know, pretty nicely. The way this is done, I think we saw a good bit of this, so I'm not going to belabor it, but I do want to just point out a couple quick pieces to it, is that each of these now are buttons, and you can see that here's the buttons, but there's only one panel. There's only one pop-up panel. Each of these buttons has a behavior associated with it. However, there's also some code behind that makes this magic work, and that code behind is determining which button was clicked and therefore which sample data needs to go into the pop-up so that we can share that pop-up.
Sure. So the idea is you've got a button. The button text shows the selection. You click on the button, and it's showing this panel which is reused between all the different buttons. And then when you select off of that pop-up, it communicates back to the button and says, here was the selection, and it updates, and you're done.
Exactly right.
Okay.
So let me open up Visual Studio on that project. Okay, John. So what we have in order to make that work is a private member variable of type descriptor. And if we go to descriptor, we see it's an enum. And then when we come down to the button press, let's take a quick look at that. When the button gets the focus, I set the descriptor to one of those three enumerated values. I set the data context, and I set the position. So let's take a look quickly at set data context, set position. What I'm doing is setting the layout route's data context to an item inside the resources dictionary where the name of that data type is the key.
Okay, so the data context is whatever it's going to bind on, and so you're saying, here's what I want you to bind on within the resources.
Exactly, and that way we can leave all the sample data in the resources, and it's going to automatically be extracted by using the name of that as the key. Then the second thing you remember was set position, and if we go to set position, here's set position, and what we're doing in set position is setting an offset and where the pop-up should appear below it. And the offset is so that we can scroll to the right position, and the top value is so that the pop-up appears in the appropriate place. Now, at the moment, I'm using magic numbers, hard-coded values. Clearly, this is something that I would like to compute based on the size and the location inside the scroll viewer.
And that's something you should be able to do that using math. Although, and that was my first thought when I saw it too, although I know that in some cases people do want to pre-compute just so that you're for speed, but I guess you could do that on application startup or as a background task during, you know, as you start up so that it's not, you know, it's async, and when you run this, the numbers are already pre-computed
right.
or something.
Exactly. And you notice, by the way, that these all line up, and that's because I just was playing with the new power tools, and one of the power tools, I believe it's Control-Alt-Square-Bracket, when you have a bunch of assignments, lines them up for you. So I just said, well,
nice.
That's kind of nice. All right, so that's really the fundamentals of what I've got in here. There is a little bit of trickery when it's time to, when the user clicks on an item in the list box, when the selection changes in the list box. At that point, we need to go and get that value out of the list box. And so we look at the descriptor to say, well, are we dealing with hair length or hair color? And let's say we're dealing with hair length. Okay, we want to set the button's content to whatever that value is. But in order to do that, we need to cast the selected item as an expression blend sample data, hair length sample data, collection item, dot, and then the description value. And that everything is the same with hair color, except that it's sample data dot hair color sample data. Now, I think there may be a more efficient way to do this with the sample data, but this certainly works, and it was interesting to find out that you can get in there and cast down to the type of the sample data, and that that is type safe. So for the moment, I'm going to leave this as it is.
And like we were saying before, I mean, this is potentially something that's continues to be hard cut into the clients, or it could even be something that's pulled back from the server. On the server, we add in a new, you know, hairstyle or whatever.
Absolutely. At the moment, we're using sample data that's been generated, and we very well may decide that that's great for design purposes, but that we want to have a proper database with all of this in it, and then we'll be approaching this completely differently.
Okay. So the flow is I click a button, the descriptor gets set, and then when the pop-up, when something's selected on the pop-up, that's how we know it, what it is.
Okay, so that was one thing that I got working. The other that I wanted to show you is the idea of a game that we might create in Silverlight as a web-based game that deals with this same data. And I'm very intrigued by the idea of complementary applications. This goes to the idea of transmedia and using the different media for their own strengths, and taking a Silverlight application that uses the data we've gathered that's related to this application, but not an exact port. And so the game is, how do I memorize, how do I learn those faces? Let me show you what I've got. I'll show you it working, and then we can quickly take it apart, because it's really very much a first cut. Okay, so the idea of this game is that you click the next button, a face comes up, you have a certain amount of time to identify that to yourself, then it comes up and tells you who it is, and you either say, yes, I got it right, or no, I didn't. And then you click next, and another face comes up, do I know who that is? Charles. I think that's Charles. Nope, it's Ulysses. So I say, and obviously I've randomized the names and the faces here. I click no, that gets a negative point, and I click
I have
next.
No idea.
Who is that guy? Edgar. Yes, I got it. And so we say, and you can imagine that over time it will show you more of the ones that have lower scores and less of the ones
right.
that have
okay.
higher
scores.
Right, okay,
so it drills scores. You on, it doesn't bug you about people you obviously know and spends more time teaching people you don't.
Right, now I have to say that after I got this about halfway, well, it was completely sketched out, and I'd begun to code it, I came across a game not all that dissimilar to this, that runs on, at least on the iPhone at the moment, it may run on other phones, that goes into your contact list where you have photos, pulls a photo out, and asks you who it is, but the way it does that is it takes three names at random, the name of the person plus two other names at random, and asks you which one it is.
I was wondering about that as you were showing me. That is kind of interesting.
The problem is that
I don't know.
If you show me somebody who I sort of remember, and you show me their name and two others, it's very easy for me to figure out which one that is, either because it jogs my memory
right.
or because I know those other two names and they're not who I'm looking for. But the challenge is when you're presented with a face with no hint, no name, and you have to come up with, now, who is that?
That's
and,
Ulysses.
Right. Very, very good, John. You get a point there. Well done. Yeah, the game works.
Right, right. This is a great game.
Now,
I love it.
For coding this, I just did a very kind of straight line path because I was really sort of partially playing and partially thinking through how I would do it. And so you'll notice that it's not test driven. It's not even MVVM. Let me get it done. And
well, and do you want to talk about that now?
Sure.
About the, so that's kind of interesting because that's obviously something where you know, when people talk about, you know, why I'm not unit testing, it's like, I just don't have time to shift everything over to that now. I can't, you know, stop everything I'm doing and convert, you know? And, I think there are definitely cases where, you know, like, testing, I think, you know, like Phil Hack uses this analogy, the vacation analogy for open source. And it's like, yeah, I'd love if everything was open source, but it's not. But more vacation is good, you know? And so
yes.
The same thing like with testing, generally more testing is good. A case where it's can get in the way is where you're just playing, like you're just sketching something out. You don't know where it's going to go. And if you were continually using tests that are, you know, verifying the behavior, well, you don't even know what the behavior is
right.
supposed
well,
to be.
Well, and the other piece to that is, because I guess the flip side argument to what you just said is that when we did the test-driven development on the repository, the test-driven helped us figure out what it was we were building, and it narrowed it down to what's the simplest thing, okay, get that working. But that was highly functional code. Whereas what I was doing
this
here
is
was almost right. This is dysfunctional code, exactly. What I was doing here was almost entirely UI driven. There's almost no logic, and the logic that there is almost self-evident. I mean, you know, you show the thing, and then there's a delay. Okay, fine, and then you say yes or no. I mean, there's really virtually no complexity to the logic. It's more about how do I get these pictures to show up, and oh yeah, that's how a dispatch timer works. And I also have to say that this entire program was written in, well, I would say well under an hour, but I think it's well under half an hour. I mean, this was not a big investment. You know, this was a, let me sketch this out and see whether I can get this basic idea working. And if I have to throw all this code away and start over, that's really okay. Mm-hmm. So that's a place. Now, you used a term earlier today, spiking, which I take to mean that kind of coding of just get all of the things I know I would do if I were doing production code out of the way, and let me just write a bunch of potentially throwaway code to get these ideas out of my head and into the compiler. Is that a fair definition of spiking?
Yeah, I think this originally came from Kent Beck in Guide to Better Small Talk. But the general idea is it's exploratory code. You're just banging something out, and in that case, you know, a test that would help you define how your code should look does get in the way because you don't know what the code is even supposed to do. So then at this point, you do have a decision where you've got to make either, do I throw this away, or do I retrofit some tests in, test after design, or test after development, and then continue forward. But
having the name spiking legitimizes this otherwise illicit behavior.
So, it's great to have a term to legitimize something, right?
It is, yes. That's one of the reasons I'm so fond of the term emerging design, because what I used to do was, well, I'll get a little working, and then I'll get a little more working, and that sounds kind of cheesy, but now I say, well, the design is emerging as I work, and now it's,
right.
Now it's cool instead of cheesy. So I was spiking. That's what I was doing. We'll get cards and letters about this, I'm sure. So you could see, and I'm not holding this code up as optimal code by any measure. In fact, I'm not even sure that the logic here has been factored properly at all. There was no attempt to do that. It was just, and there's not a lot here. It's just the question of, can I get this basic idea going? And then, you know, do we like this idea? Do we want to make it look a little bit better? And then what other functionality do we want to add? And then, okay, let's sit down and, you know, write this properly is kind of the way I was thinking about it. And so this is I would call it sketch flow for developers, you know, or RAD programming with C#, or I'm not sure what it is. But the interesting thing is you can, you know, I mean, it's pretty much what I set out to do, basically works. So it does show an image and then the person's name.
Quint.
That kind of works. I needed a cue. What can I tell you?
Yeah. Do you want to show generally the flow? I mean,
sure,
I know absolutely. You're saying this could be a throwaway, but...
Absolutely. Okay, so let's take a quick look at it. Everything happens in main pages, and in the code behind, there's no view model or any such luxuries here. This is, as we said, Spike City. So the first thing that happens is we set up a couple event handlers for the three buttons, a few event handlers, and we set up the timer. The timer is a dispatch timer. I looked at using a timer and then using the dispatcher to send messages across to the visual thread. It seemed a lot more straightforward to just use a dispatch timer. The dispatch timer is going to want for its interval a time span, so I defined underbar name delay as a time span of 3 seconds. And you can imagine as a feature of this program that the user is able to adjust the time span. Do the names come more quickly? Do they come more slowly as you get to know the names? Or potentially that's tied to the score. So the ones that you don't know very well, you get a little more time. But in any case, that brings us down to line 26. That's all set up. On line 27, I call get people, and you can see that on lines 32 through 38, and all I'm doing there is I've chosen a number of people based on the number of, you know, a small number of images, so that was 25, and for each one, I add, I call the static method person.randomPerson. Let's go look at that very quickly, go to definition. So this is my person class. Each person has a name. They have the URI of where their picture is, and they have the score. That's the plus one, minus one. And then I set up a list of first names that I just wrote at random for each one to represent a letter of the alphabet. My images I threw into a folder and just named them A through X. So what I want to do at this point is create a person by generating a random number on line 23 and then translating that random number into a capital letter on line 24. And then we jump down to line 27, and we can assemble the path to that image by taking the initial path, which is E My Pictures Faces slash, then the capital letter, then .jpg, and the URI is assembled and put into the new person that we just created, along with taking that same random number as an offset into my collection of names. And so that associates a name with an image, and we initialize their score to zero and return that. So that brings us back where we were, which is over here. We did this get people. We do that 25 times, so we have 25 images with names associated. And then we call setPicture, and setPicture simply goes and, well, the first thing it does is it sets the current person. And that's just one line. It says current person equals, and it takes my collection of people and randomly picks one. And then the next thing it does is it sets the picture source to be a bitmap based on the URI of the current person, that the current person is carrying that picture URI with them. So we just go get that image. And then we call name display. And this is the only place where anything gets the slightest bit interesting or complicated, is in name display. What we want to do is first set the visibility of the name to collapsed, and then set both the no button and the yes button to disabled, and start the timer. The timer is going to run for 3 seconds. When it completes, timer tick is going to be called. At that point, we're going to set the name text to the current person's name and make that visible, and set yes and no to enabled. And that will give you the opportunity to say yes, I knew it, or no, I didn't. And then you can see that the handlers either increment or decrement based on whether you chose yes or there's no here, and call set next. And set next goes and takes the person and the score and displays them, disables the yes and no button, enables the next button, and then when you click next, we call set picture and start over.
Okay.
So yeah, that was kind of a whirlwind tour, but you know, it's pretty simple, pretty straightforward. I think the way you would do it if you were banging out code, not necessarily the way you would do it if you were building production code, although it will be interesting to go through this and do it again with an eye towards production code and see how different it is, because I'm not sure it'll be terribly different.
Yeah, it's true. Like you're saying, you could, like using an MVVM framework, you can just update your model and, excuse me, I guess you'd update your view model and the binding would update itself, right? So you wouldn't have to be setting things on the page. You could just be updating your view model and let the bindings update.
Correct.
Magically.
Right. And there are many places where that separation of concern is more than paid back in easier maintainability and extensibility. And this application, I suspect, is, at least at the moment, is at the border of warranting doing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, this is cool.
That's a bit of progress on both, at least we have a start on something happening on the Silverlight client, and we have pretty much a working first page, needs some cleanup on the phone, and on the back-end server, we have our repository and some good start on the design. So we've got things cooking on a bunch of different burners at once, and we can move forward from here. I think we're in pretty solid shape for a few days worth of work.
Yep. Yeah, it's nice to see everything kind of, as I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, okay, we need to capture this field. We need to capture this. We need to keep track of picture, you know, and then, you know, going back on that, like looking at the phone client, thinking, okay, well, we'll need pictures in there at some point. I mean, there's a lot of, I guess, like you're saying, everything drives each other. You can see the design emerging.
Yes. And I will say that now that we have a shared repository for our code and that we're using Mercurial, and I know we plan to talk about Mercurial in some depth and for folks who are interested, show how it's obtained and how it's set up. But the fact that this is now under source code control and shared source code control in a way that's very fast and unobtrusive makes it very easy to do this kind of experimenting and go off on to trying things without fear of any kind of destruction along the way.
Right. Yep. Yeah, that goes back to one of the things we were talking about in the test-driven development episode where we're saying, you know, doing as much as we can so that we can code without fear is what I like to call it, where you're able to just kind of, hey, I'd like to do this, and you do it, and you don't think, well, I'd like to do this, but I can't really do that because I might cause some problems, I might get stuck, I might, you know.
So, right. And I just, yeah. I will point out, since we're talking about it, I mean, it is frighteningly fast. If I go to Who Is That, which has inside here is the phone, but it's also a demo that I wrote, it's the server code, it's the client code, and you'll notice I've changed the Silverlight client code and I've changed the phone code. When I mm-hmm. go back to the parent directory, right click and say go ahead and commit that, it's going to come up and show me what I'm committing. And then the speed with which this is committed, it's going to require that I put in a comment. I know that's coming. So let me put in that this was for demo on Vidcast. And then I'm going to hit commit, and boom, it's done. That's committed, at least locally. Now, I can at this point, if I want, upload this to the external repository. But that's all it took to commit this back in and know that I have a safe versioned copy.
Now, I'm really looking forward to like doing a whole episode on this and what we're doing to manage the project. You know,
in that case, I won't go any further, and I won't point out that I can now push this.
Definitely should not do that.
Server. I wouldn't do that because that would undermine what you're talking about. So I won't.
Yep. Well, if you're watching this and you do have any questions on or comments on, you know, what we're doing with source control or how we're managing the project in general, please let us know.
And feel free to let us know that all of that falderall about why I didn't do this test driven on my spiking. I'd actually be very interested in folks' reaction to how much you do that kind of plowing ahead and then coming back to refactor and clean and make it production level, because there's no doubt in my mind that there are times when I just need to get this down onto, I would say paper, but into the compiler and get more of a concrete sense of what's going to work before I back up and write clean production code. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I really have come to believe is that if I find myself repeating a pattern of work, even if it defies what the current wisdom is, if I keep going back to it, then there's probably a reason I keep going back to it. Now, that may be that I have bad habits, and it may be that I haven't thought it through, but sometimes it's because we can tend to get a little bit too orthodox in our approach and let that orthodoxy get in the way of being productive. And so I trust my gut enough that And I found enough benefit out of things like TDD that I'm doing TDD when it comes to production code. But when my gut says, let's just get this written, you know, I'm willing to go with that. And at some point, someone will come along and call it spiking or emerging design, or they'll come up with another good name for, you know, path clearing, deforestation. I'm not sure what they'll call it, but it'll be given a good name.
Yeah, I do like that when the way I've been working for a while comes into vogue, and I'm like, oh, nice.
Right, suddenly I'm hip.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's what we have for today. So for Microsoft and the Full Stack, this is Jesse Liberty.
And this is John Galloway.